This is After Dark number 5. This is tape number 9, and this is side 2. Let's get right back into our roundtable of DX Audio Service editors and questions from you, the membership. Here's Ann Nashoff.
10 years ago, all this was just science fiction. Mm-hmm. When you look into your little engineer's mind, what would you like to see 10 years down the road? I mean, give me your big dream of what you'd like to see that there isn't technology for yet.
Technology-wise, yeah. I think the big thing I would like to see is the ability to take information and be able to trade it easier through access means. For example, your station would have a connection point like they do with internet, whereby I could go in and say, you know, geez, I wonder if there's anything that Ann has on Mayor Berger talking about the revitalization of downtown, and be able to call your computer and just see what you have, and as long as you have this stuff available to the public, be able to pull down whatever news piece that is. And likewise, if you're doing a story, say, on you're doing a story on, say, the history of RCA, you could call over to my system here and see what I have archived in my system. That information is often hard to come by because you have to go to a library and start thumbing through pieces of paper and stuff, or on internet, sit there for an hour and a half and try to find a piece of subject matter that maybe you don't even know if it even exists. If you could put out a query through a system and be able to find that information, I think it's going to make it a lot easier for us as people in the media, but also for the average person who just has a curiosity.
Do you think there will ever be a media that will compete with FM that will have the impact that FM had on AM?
I think there will be. I think, you know, the going back on some of our history things, you mentioned about the cart machines. 10 years ago, I remember, or actually, yeah, 10 years ago, I was working up in Detroit, and a guy said to me, he says, you know, I hear they're experimenting around with putting carts onto floppy disks. And I remember sitting there with my cup of coffee in my hand, surly as heck, saying, you gotta be kidding me. Putting audio on floppy disks? What are you crude or something? Well, now look what's going on.
Right.
I remember saying to myself when CDs came out, you know, well, they'll always have 45s at radio stations. Okay, now whatever happened to 45s? I don't know too many stores that are selling them.
I have hundreds in a box that haven't been touched in years.
Me too. And, you know, I think that somewhere down the line, what is going to happen is there's going to be a mass exodus to a new media, and I think that's going to either be satellite or distribution by fiber. I know you probably know PrimeStar mm-hmm. is up and it's running. It does have some faults. I think John Bowker can explain it better than I can, but the problem is basically with the signal coming out of the heavens. If you have a storm or something where you have a lot of rain and a cloud pass between you and the satellite, you lose a signal. But I think once fiber is in, you know, you're going to see a lot of changes in the media. It's just bound to happen, because the signals are going to be able to be disseminated around a lot easier.
Speaking of signals, we have another question for John. Why do digital signals fall off?
Those tests, I know, are being performed as we speak here in the fall of 1994. I can only respond because I don't have an answer to your question, but I'm moved to say this. I know that their main concern is what is called graceful degradation of the analog signal. That is, as you drive away from the radio station to which you're tuned, it gets weaker and weaker and noisier and noisier, and finally you just say, oh, the heck with it, I'm going to tune to a better station. With digital, it isn't that way at all. You are driving along and suddenly your radio goes dead. And you think, what's wrong with my radio? Doggone it, you know. And that's the way the station disappears, because it is digital. It has all these check digits coming out. And if a check digit gets missed by the radio, it squelches itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not a graceful degradation at all. And they're worried about that, because honestly, you're driving along, you got this wonderful song playing in your all through your car on 28 different loudspeakers probably, and all of a sudden, it's dead.
Well, not just songs, but what if you're listening to Rush Limbaugh and he's pounding the table and making a great point? I don't mind listening through a little bit of static or going through a tunnel.
And you know what bothers me is you always hear, you know, people say, well, when that happens, well, the station was editing what he was saying. No, it's not editing. There's a little rain fade there, for God's sakes. Of course, you know, some of us are a little bit more, you know, in depth to knowing what happens when the satellite feed goes away. You know, I'm probably one of the only people that doesn't call your radio station when you lose your satellite signal and threaten you with censorship or something. But I know, it happens at the TV station where I work. You know, we lose the satellite signal during the soap operas in the afternoon, and I think about 90% of the little old ladies call us over the TV station and threaten us with bodily harm because, you know, we're doing away with their stories.
Right.
But nothing you can do about it. If the signal falls off, you're dead.
Fred, I think what they are really thinking is that when a radio does fall off the edge, as they call it, that it will, by then, be making use of this new system where the radio can find the next strongest country music station because it knows that's what you want, or the next most strongest signal from a news or a sports station. Whatever you've got the radio set to right now, when that station gets so weak that it can't receive it anymore, it's going to switch over to something, to a closer station that is broadcasting the same kind of program material. That's possible technically right now, as you know. They have radios now that tell you right on the dial what station you're listening to, and it gives you the call letters, not just the frequency.
Yeah, RDBS.
All right, well, that's right. And that's what it's called for the FM system. I don't know what the AM people are coming up with yet, but
yeah. They're
working on it.
Do you think they're going to change that so it is a gradual fade out?
I think in television it's going to be hard. I think television is going to be very difficult because of the fact that with television you have to take and basically figure out a way of gracefully causing a degradation of a signal. With radio, I think it might be a little easier because what you can do is rather than just losing the signal, you can make it fall off in steps. Basically go from CD quality to... what is, I guess, a bad term to use since we're a medium wave club, but to AM radio quality, and then maybe down to a phone line quality. And then once it gets below the phone line quality, I guess you call it quits. But I certainly think, you know, that there's got to be a happy medium.
I agree completely, and it goes into the FM, too, what with the Pickett-Pence effects when you get at a distance from a station. I'm sure everybody has witnessed, I guess, as you put on the brakes and come to a stoplight, you know, 50 miles from the station you're listening to, the station goes as though we were going through a picket fence.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I don't know why they couldn't have some kind of defeat mechanism that would say to the radio, well, you're going to be garbled every now and then, but I'm going to put up with that and allow that to be received.
Either that or some kind of method where it drops back in audio response, like from 15 kilohertz to 5 kilohertz or whatever.
With FM being the favorite son of listeners, what are the AM stations having to do to stay alive?
Well, I think we may have touched on that in the last question when we talked about digital audio delivery into the home. If the experiments work out that AM stations are going to be able to convert to a digital broadcasting, that certainly is going to perk up the AM industry. The experiments in Cincinnati, by the way, are being conducted in that analog and digital is being transmitted at the same time on the same frequency, and they don't appear to interfere with each other, so there can be a period of transition where stations will be able to broadcast both analog and digital audio at the same time. And I think that is eventually going to keep AM stations alive if they can hang on until that happens.
You'll find that the most AM stations really, I believe, tend to be involved with their markets. They are very active in the community. They promote themselves well. They also tend to get a lot of their listeners involved with the station. If you look at a lot of the major stations, like, for example, KDKA and KNBR and WOR and so on, they're very much in touch with the market, with their listeners. Their listeners are very much a part of the station. And all those stations, I am sure, have a long-term game plan to be the dominant station in the market. And I really believe that listener involvement in serving the marketplace is probably the number one method that AM stations today can use to stay dominant in their market.
You know, with some of these broadcasters and shock jocks that are on the air, John, do you think the FCC nowadays really has the teeth to enforce the dirty radio that's going on right now?
Do they have the teeth? Yes, they have the teeth. There's another part of the anatomy they're lacking. I don't know what you're thinking, Fred.
I got a pretty good idea, and I think I kind of agree with you.
The problem that the commission has is that it is the only part of the United States government that is responsive directly to the Congress. Maybe you weren't aware of that. In other words, they are not. The commissioners are appointed by the president, but that's the last control the president has over the FCC. They do not come in through a branch, through one of the cabinets. They aren't like the, by the way, all military radios, all government-owned radio installations, you know, are not controlled by the FCC. The FCC controls only about a third of all of the available radio frequencies.
Who controls the military?
The military is controlled by an organization called the NTIA, National Telecommunications Information Administration. They got all the long words they could get in that, I think. And I have right here in front of me the NTIA rulebook. It's dated 1990. Forgive me. That's just after I retired, and they kept sending them to me. And I said, don't send me any more of those. They're 2,000-page books of regulations, just like the FCC, only much more strict. The radios that the military and the government use are much more strict. The FCC does not have security clearance. In other words, if I want to come to you and say, hey, I got a great, Mr. Commissioner, I have a great idea for how we're going to slam dunk the enemy on radio. They're going to say, oh, I'm so, don't tell me you'll be violating the security. You have to go over to the NTIA with that kind of a thing. That sounds like another subject for us to discuss sometime, Fred.
It's kind of interesting that you're saying that because of the FCC being so open with public notices and public information that there's really no secret that they could keep.
Well, that's about what it amounts to. You have a good point. I hadn't thought of it quite that way, but you're right, absolutely. But I did avoid making my main point a moment ago, too, and that is since they respond directly to the Congress, that means that any congressman who is bothered by an FCC decision, all he's got to do is go over and see his good friend Charlie or Jim, or now they've got a couple of ladies on the commission too, and you can be sure that the commission will rescind its latest order, will revisit is the word they use, one of their recent decisions that might affect the health of a radio station in southern Kentucky, for instance. I'm making this up as I go along, of course. You know, what can I say? There was a move in Congress recently, which was called the Anti-Rush Bill. I don't know if you were aware of that.
Isn't that the Hush Rush?
Yes, okay. Okay, it depends about who you talk to, what it's called. That would materially affect the Freedom of Speech Acts of broadcasters, who have fought long and hard and have won a lot of battles. You know, this whole business about, particularly this time of year, Fred, as I'm sure you know, even at the television end, the people running for office who come into you and demand the minimum rate, isn't it, and want to have something that you may not edit. And you could have some person running for Congress who sees he's been beat, and he might as well give up. He could easily come on to your television station or any radio station in your town and put on a frightful, frightful speech. And it has happened. And there is no way you can edit that man's comments. Or woman. I don't mean to be sexist in this. But the thing that happened was a man came on half in the bag or half drunk, I guess, and knew that he was losing, and it was 3 days before the election, and he came on and he told that electorate a thing or two about what they could do with their votes. And the station got in touch with the FCC, said that they had was not up to broadcast standards, and they were told, hey, you broadcast it. An informed electorate. We want the electorate to know what this person said. And from that standpoint, hey, it makes a lot of sense. But I'm glad my grandchildren were here listening to this guy.
What market did that happen in?
Don't ask me that. But it happened not 2 years ago, but I believe it was 4 years ago. It was on one of the, 6 years ago. It was an off-year election. And so, you know, it wasn't that it got buried in with presidential politics. It got pretty good hearing.
What are some of the most unusual AM stations on the air today?
Some of the most unusual AM stations on the air, well, I do a lot of traveling and have a chance to hear a lot of small stations in little tiny isolated markets, and some of them are unique. There's a station in Taos, New Mexico, which broadcast in the Taos Indian language, although in the afternoons they play regular top 40 type music, so you will hear the same CHR type music you'll hear anywhere, except the announcements are all in the Taos language, which is a really unusual sounding language, and it's a strange station to hear if you don't speak Taos, and let's face it, how many of us do?
And now back to Fred and some more personal questions.
Uh-oh.
You have some groupies out there that like you. What is your favorite part of the country?
Without a doubt, North Dakota and Northern Michigan.
Why?
North Dakota, I like the serenity. I guess the best way of putting it is, first time I was out there, I went out with my brother-in-law to a local bar in Keefe, North Dakota. Walked in on this, I swear to God, the bar had three stools. That's it. So you walk in and you sit down and basically you sit there and just talk with the local people. That and being in North Dakota and, sitting down, talking with the Indians about culture and stuff that I never, as a sheltered little boy in Toledo, Ohio, never even knew existed. And, going into Northern Michigan, for example, where you have the pine trees and the nice fishing lakes and stuff, and just, you know, sitting down talking with the locals. I guess that's the thing I really like to do, is just talk with people and find out, you know, what's going on in your part of the country. What do you do? You know, why do you do this?
It's radio without a microphone.
Exactly. I mean, it's basically, what would we call that? Talk stool? I mean, so you're sitting there on the stool with a Coca-Cola and, you know, talking to a guy and asking him questions about, you know, what was the question I remember asking this guy in Keefe, North Dakota? It was something along, oh, I know. I it was during farming season. And I asked him, I says, you know, I see you guys out there cutting this stuff. And then I see these big bins with this thing that looks like a furnace, you know, going like a bat out of Hades onto the stuff that you've just picked. Why do you do that? And I, you know, the first thought is, well, if you're picking corn, you're making popcorn. You just, you know, Or you're just doing this to dry it out or something like that. Found out that they do this to bring up the moisture and the protein of the corn, so it's actually worth more to the elevator when they sell it.
Now, I had no idea.
No idea. I mean, just as little tidbits of information. Gosh, I better get on the phone and call 1-800-HI-DAVID. I got some good questions for him.
And then Bob H. wants to know, who are some of your mentors in the business and why?
Oh, comedy, Gary Burbank. Gary Burbank, I think, is one of the most ingenious people for coming up with stuff on the spur of the moment and being able to do funny material. Announcer, Gary Owens. I think Gary Owens has one of the best radio voices I've heard in a long time. One of the old timers. Articulation, Rush Limbaugh. I think Rush is one of the guys I'd love to interview on the DX audio service, but he's turned us down every time we've asked for an interview. Rush gives me the impression, and again, I don't know the man. I never met him. I've listened to him. But he gives me the impression that when he grew up in his home, his father was a lawyer and his father's father was a lawyer. And I get the feeling that around their table at night, they used to speak, you know, about some really interesting issues. And that if he mispronounced a word or came up with something which was rather lame brain, that he got lambasted at the table for it. and I really respect the man for his articulation. I think he comes off very, very well. As far as a news person goes, that's a hard one. I really don't see, you know, the problem with news and radio nowadays is you got some people writing and some people talking. It's not like the old days where you you had one person who wrote and spoke. But I'd have to say right now, probably the one that I respect the most is Tom Brokaw. And I think, you know, when you, if you'd mold that all, if you'd mold those four people into it, I think you'd have a super announcer. Be able to do a funny newscast too.
Tell us some funny radio stories.
Just to tell you kind of a funny story, and this was from a station in Ohio about 25 years ago. I had a good friend of mine who was a, he was the all-night announcer on a station, down in Cincinnati. And he ran the AM side, but the AM announcer also had to, periodically go in and check the FM automation equipment and make sure everything was working properly. And being that he was on overnights on the AM and, wasn't probably a very large audience on the FM, he made a little, modification in the normal way things usually work on the FM one night. This is an old automation system that had the music reels, on one machine. And the voice tracks that would coincide with these music reels would be on a separate tape and be played back on a separate tape deck. It was a full track tape that played the voice, and it was, of course, turned on and off by 25 hertz Q tones. And this friend of mine went over to the FM one night about midnight and set up the music tape on the automation system. He took the voice tape and rewound it. Put it on the, put it in the automation system so that the voice tracks would play backwards. And of course, on this station in the middle of the night, then you would hear, something that sounded like Russian coming across the airwaves. And, I really don't know if he got any calls on it. I know the night that he did that, we were away from the station listening to this. And we were just, there were a bunch of us there, we were just rolling on the floor with laughter, because when the voice track would come up, you'd hear it all played backwards, and it sounded like something out of a foreign country. But that was pretty funny. He did that a number of times and never got caught, and ended up being a major morning personality in the market. And I, just to kind of protect this individual, who happens to be general manager of a radio station in Ohio today. I won't give any names, but there's my funny contribution to this segment of After Dark.
There's also some other things that, you know, some other interesting pranks we used to do back in 19, I'm showing my age now here, Ann.
Especially when you can't remember it.
Yeah, well, you know, I get old and senile. back when I was working up in Archbold, Ohio, we used to have some trick. No, actually, it wasn't Archbold. It was Eau Claire, Wisconsin. They had an interesting principle in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. For people who know how a CURT machine works, you have a what's called a secondary cue button, which is supposed to kick the next item. The station had wired up on their console where you would do the commercial, and at the end of the commercial, on your last word, you'd push the sec button, secondary tone button. And what it would do is, on the air, it would start the next thing. So everything was real nice and tight. But what it would do in the studio was, it would take whatever was on that cart and put it in queue. So what a lot of guys would do, just for grins, would, they'd say, like, be doing a commercial and say, visit Joe Iveson Chevrolet Jeep Geo, where the low price is not a boast, it's a, you know, promise. And then they'd hit the stop, you know, hit the little sec button, which would then, of course, start the next thing. After they let off the sec button, they'd say, and that's an outright lie. And, of course, the guy in the studio was sitting there listening on his headphones would hear that, you know, hear that little bit there, and then a lot of times they'd crack him up. It nailed me once or twice.
As long as it doesn't slip and keep going on the air.
No, they never did, but it got to be a contest until the general manager put a squash on it.
Well, three or four come to mind that obviously we can't tell in mixed company, so let's see. Well, there was one time. Actually, when you've been in the business as long as I have, there are 1,000 of these, so it's kind of hard to pick one. It's like having a box of chocolates, as Forrest Gump once said. But anyway, I remember one time there was a fellow who worked in our news department who used to like to go outside and have a smoke right before he did his newscast. He had that nasty, evil habit of smoking cigarettes. And he would come flying into the newsroom with just seconds to go. Usually he would hear the intro to the newscast, and that would be his cue to flick out the cigarette and to run down the hall and jump on his chair and roll over to the desk where he delivered the newscast. One day, people whose names will not be discussed here decided to remove the rollers from the bottom of the chair. Well, Paul came flying down the hall as the news opening was going, hit the chair, went to slide across the room like he always did from his typing position over to the broadcasting desk, and of course Paul went, and the chair didn't. And Paul ended up underneath the desk, and at that time the news intro ended, and he reached up and opened up the mic and actually did a newscast on his knees.
Radio is one of those things where you do come across some very funny stories. And I'll tell you, that's one thing I really wish somebody would have done back about 20 years ago is culminated all these funny stories into a book. Because there are some hilarious things. You talk with people who are in Chicago and Denver and Texas and wherever. Everyone's got a funny story. And I'm sure you've probably got a few from Cincinnati, and Russ probably has a few stories, and I bet you if you talk to Marty, he can tell you some good Cleveland stories. I mean, there's always some funny story from some area that's happened to some poor schnook on the air. And it's funny to listen to because you're sitting there, and part of it is just because it's funny. And the other part is like, yeah, I can see how that would happen.
And yeah, it happened to me once too.
Yeah. You knocked over those carts and then swore in the air. Oh yeah, I see how that happened.
I dropped a stack of about 40 carts once onto a turntable while it was playing. Talk about a racket.
We used to have a thing at a station I worked at up in Archbold, Ohio, WHFD, where we used to have a contest to see how many carts you could carry through the hall. And that was kind of interesting. I think the record was held by a guy named Joe Gunderman. I think he carried, now this guy was very tall, and he could squat down and carry 64 carts, I think is the record. And I had tried to beat that record, and another guy had tried to beat the record. This other guy, as he was carrying them through, got into the air studio just as the sports guy opened up his microphone. Then he dropped all the cards, which was kind of interesting.
Bill H. wants to know, besides the DX audio service, do you do other readings, and do you do this for a living?
Don't do it for a living, no. I made a pact with myself many, many years ago when we started the audio service to do this solely as a volunteer. I don't make a cent off of it. And actually, there's a lot of, if you want to call it, Vobe money, which goes into the audio service. I put a lot into it just because I like doing it. I have done other readings for people only because I look at it this way. You and I are gifted with the value of sight. We can go to any place we want in Lima, pick up any magazine we want, and be able to read anything we want. We have access to it. We can read it if we so choose. There's a lot of blind people that don't have that ability. And there's a lot of information, especially when you get into these specific things such as radio and technology, that nobody's interested in really reading. So, yes, occasionally I will get into a situation where someone will say, hey, can you read this for me, this article? And I'll read it for them. But I always make it as a proviso. Don't attempt to pay me. Don't ask me if I want any money. If you feel you have to give something, you know, yeah, give me an air check of a station in your town or something like that. But I don't like to make it a business. I don't know, call it, I guess kind of like morally, I just feel morally, responsible for providing something that I know a lot of people can't have.
Do all the DXAS editors feel that way?
I think so.
None of them get paid?
None of them get paid. All of us are volunteers. The magazine costs $25 per year, and all that money goes strictly to pay for the postage and the cassettes and the boxes and such. And any remainder that we have above that at the end of the year, we take that and put that into what we call our publications department to be able to pay for, say, calling up Jonathan Marks from Radio Netherlands and doing an interview with him, because obviously a phone call for an hour and a half with someone in the Netherlands is going to cost a little bit of money. So basically any extra money which we generate from the dues goes to researching future projects which we can do. And it's kind of a snowball effect. If we can generate more magazines and more issues and more interesting topics, then that is something which provides a service, and then any fee we get from that, we just kick that back into the next project. In the printed side of the National Radio Club with the magazine, they have over 500 different technical articles, which I don't know of any other place where you can find them in print. And it's just because they take this stuff, they research it, they put it together, sell it, any profit they make, they turn it around. But to answer your original question, not one editor has ever been paid a cent in their life. Most of us are diehard radioholics.
Do they stick around?
Oh, yeah.
You don't have any trouble keeping them on?
No.
Just totally volunteer?
No, there's been many times that John Bowker's asked me to get the hell out of the studio, but I don't think I've...
That could be personal.
Yeah, no. John and I are good friends. I like to egg him on, but we've only had, I think, one or two editors leave. There was a young lady who did a ratings column, and she left because she got into law, and basically she just didn't have the time to research the information and then, you know, go to school to become a lawyer. We also had another guy who left because he got into the business of some kind of business which deals with heating and cooling, but it's like instead of like air conditioners like you and I think, it's like heating and cooling to Cobo Hall up in Detroit. You know, it's a big major industry, and, you know, because of that, he just didn't have the time. But, you know, Jerry Starr's been with us. John Bowker's been with us. Phil Wayne's been with us just about since the beginning of the whole service.
Is there room for more editors, or would you like contributors? How does that work?
Yeah, we do contributors, especially on this tape like we're doing, this After Dark. We take pretty much anything that we can get from any source, NPR, BBC, anyone who has something of interest which deals with radio. And I also encourage, in talking to different people, encourage people like yourself who are in the news media, you find something of interest that's about radio, about either broadcast radio or the technology of radio, hey, throw it on tape. We'll put it on our tape and then send it out to send it out to our membership. Because a lot of times, you know, little tidbits will come down Associated Press or UPI or something, and, you know, that stuff never hits the air. No one ever knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kind of things which are really interesting. The little known facts. You know, hearing about KDKA's tower being destroyed because you know, it's been up since 1938, and it's now rusted, and they got to get it down before it actually falls down. So, how did they do that? How did they, you know, how do you keep a 50,000 watt clear channel radio station on the air while you're changing towers? And it's those little tidbits that are very interesting sometimes.
I'll have to watch for them.
Yeah. Also also histories. Histories are very interesting. You know, when you look at the progression of something, how did it begin? You know, like, again, falling back on your station, you know, why did WCIT begin? I mean, who was the people that put it on? Why did they choose the frequency they did? Now, I was lucky back when I first started, two people were alive back when I first moved to Lima. Maury Lamb, who was the chief engineer of WLIO at the time, and Easter Straker. I was lucky enough to ask some of those questions, and I found out some interesting, you know, highlights about that WCIT originally was in contest with a station in Sydney, Ohio, who also wanted 940. And apparently, both stations had excellent engineering applications put together. They had proof that the community needed the station. They could show that there was a need for radio in their area. And as it turned out, somebody finally got together and said, well, you know, maybe Lima should get 940, but let's give Sydney, Ohio, 1080. And both people, parties in the disputes back said, you know, that might work. So Lima got 940, Sydney, Ohio got their station. And that's basically how it happened. Also, you know, in talking about history, you know, one thing that always mesmerized me for many, many years was, I remember Maury Lamb, the chief engineer at WLIO. When I first started, he took me around the building and he showed me this, and you've probably seen our TV station. It's basically an old house, and then you have newer structure built to the side and along in the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
And as he walked through, he said, you know, now, this is where WLOK was. I'm sitting there thinking, LOK? He says, yeah, there was a radio station here. I said, there was? He says, yeah, WLOK. I said, well, what frequency were there on? 1240. 1240? I don't even remember. There's no station in Lima on 1240. Well, there was. There was WLOK and WIMA. WIMA in 1953 bought the TV station. And because you couldn't own two radio stations, you had to get rid of one. So they kept 1150, threw away the 1240. So here Lima had actually three AM stations at one time.
Isn't LOK the station Hugh Downs got his start on?
Yeah. Yeah, he started at WLOK and the other call sign, WBLY, down in, I'm taxing my memory here. I can't remember what city it was. He was from this area originally.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you find these little bits of history which are just interesting.
You know, it always bothers me when new management comes in and they'll get rid of call letters that have been around forever. You know, I worked at WCKY in Cincinnati, and they mm-hmm. had their call letters for 60-some years. New management came in last year, and all of a sudden, they're WSAI.
Yeah.
You know, which used to be another station on the dial, which also had...
1360.
Yeah, I mean, that was great call letters for years. That was the rock and roll station, and then new owners came in and got rid of SAI.
And 550 changed, too.
They're CKY
now. Yeah, they're
now.
Not WCKY. They were WKRC, and,
I can't figure out why they do that, when you have that tradition.
You know, I think a lot of times... ownership does not respect the tradition, does not respect the integrity of broadcasting. I mean, there's two types of broadcasters, and I know I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to really peeve some people off. There's two types of broadcasters. There's the guy who goes into the station, buys a station, and strictly bottom-line oriented. He can care less what the audience thinks. He can care less what the people there think. He's going to operate that thing and make the most profit he can. You also have the broadcaster, who goes in there and he's interested in making a profit, but he does it because he cares about the community. And you see some of these organizations which go into some of these old time stations like CKY and stuff, and they completely bastardize the station.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there are some stations which have held on to their integrity. The one thing that always hurts me when I see happen is when you see an old line call letter, like say like WWJ in Detroit. If they were ever to take that station and make it, you know, change the call letters, of course, now the FCC says if you drop a three-letter call, you never get it back. It's gone for good. That's always sad. It's also sad for me to see a call sign which has some significance wind up on some little BS station where they're playing jukebox music or something.
Mm-hmm.
And you sit there and you think to yourself, well, like WCFL, for example, WCFL in Chicago. That was one of my favorite radio stations. I just love that station. And then, you know, to see it on some little, 250-watt daytimer out of Podunk, New Jersey or something like that, which is, playing satellites, you know, format or something, it just gets me, I guess.
Well, you know, most managers start out as salespeople, mm-hmm. and the salespeople were never on the air.
That's true. That's true. And unfortunately, a lot of managers don't necessarily look at the overall picture of what they're doing. It you know, I'm a businessman. I look at the bottom line. But at the same time, I have a certain amount of pride and integrity. I could never go into a station such as CIT, for example, and say, you know, we could make some more money if we just cut out all these people and just play the satellite stuff all day.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know, number one, it ain't gonna work. Number two, I'm going to look at that and I'm going to say, what is the community going to think of me? And what am I providing for my community? That's one of the things I've always looked at is the old phrase, on October 12th, W so-and-so was granted license by the Federal Communications Commission to operate in the public interest as a public trustee. That phrase, to me, means a lot. I think that if you own a station, you owe something to your community. You need to do something for your community. You have to provide a service. If you're not going to provide a service, to quote Jim Snowbarger, get the hell off the frequency.
Well, then you get back to what is public interest. We were talking about that before we started taping. You know, and if people are interested in Howard Stern, is that public interest?
it's a very touchy thing, because, you know, you get to a personal preference. You know, you look at public interest from a standpoint of, okay, if they like it, then it must be interesting. On the other hand, what is your liability for providing material? You know, if your station was to provide Howard Stern, what is your liability toward the community of Lima? I'm sure that in a community such as Lima, if WCIT played Howard Stern, the phones would be ringing off the wall from irate listeners.
Right.
But there are communities where that is an accepted norm. Now, whether that is to your and my liking, who knows?
Well, and if the community is not offended by it, and what he says is the accepted norm, is it dirty?
Exactly.
And can the FCC regulate that if the community accepts it?
Yeah, and what is your perception of dirty? I mean, to some people, the word heck, I mean, if I say heck in front of my daughter, she chastises me. Okay. However, I've been around, you know, people in, I got one relative who's an old farmer. And, you know, if you mention the name Clinton, he brings about four explicitives up in relation to his name. So, I mean, you know, that, to him, it doesn't matter. But, you know, on the other hand, my daughter, you know, I say heck and it's like, Dad, you said a dirty word. You know, it's like, well, heck is not actually a dirty word. It's an abbreviation for Hector. That's what it is. Yeah, I have to gracefully lie my way out of it or make an apology. But, you know, I, you look at what's happening up in Cleveland, right? For example, you got Don Imus in Cleveland, and you have Howard Stern, and both stations are doing extremely well. And you have to wonder, okay, if they're doing extremely well, that means there's a lot of people listening to it. What does that say for Cleveland?
Not much. Do they like it, or are they shocked by it?
I don't know. I mean, it goes back to like Limbaugh. You know, what is attraction to Limbaugh? You know, some people say that it's because the guy says something which you believe, but you're afraid to say. Mm-hmm. Other people say it's the entertainment, and there's still another faction which says they like him because he's easy to argue with. Well, okay, which side do you take? I mean, I listen to him because I find him entertaining, and occasionally he does make a good point. Like I said, he's very articulate, and a lot of times there may be something like on the subject of going to war with Haiti or something like that I may have an opinion on, but then he says something that maybe makes a little bit more sense, and it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I see that. So there is some news value as you know, to his program.
Well, people will call the station and they'll say, I listen to Rush Limbaugh every day and I can't stand him.
Yeah.
But they're listening every day.
Yeah, well, that's just it. And there's people that do the same thing with Howard Stern and such. We'll pick up the rest of our roundtable with WCIT News Radio 94's Ann Nashif and our editors of the DX Audio Service when we go over to tape number 10.